Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this, the third Jean Monnet lecture. The first, as you will recall, was given by Jacques Delors, and the second by Ernest Gellner. And this evening's occasion is graced by Professor Alan Millwood, who, as I'm sure you all know, is Professor of Economic History here in the school, and is the author of a number of books, starting, I think, most importantly with his book on the economics of the Third Reich, and progressing through a number of major studies of the politics of the European economy during the Second World War, during the Cold War, and most recently the reconstruction of Western Europe and the European rescue of the nation state. Alan Millwood is the best kind of economic historian. By that I mean that while he is a distinguished economist, he writes in a way that can be understood by human beings. This also means that he gives lectures in a way that can be understood by human beings. And for that reason, I'm sure you'd rather be listening to him than to me. And so it's my very great pleasure to welcome him now to speak to us about Britain, Europe and the World, 1961 to 1963. Thank you, Professor Millwood.
Thank you. Over the last 3 years, there has been an intense discussion in print over the question of why the United Kingdom's first application for membership of the European Community failed. Briefly, to recapitulate the story, the Conservative government of Harold Macmillan decided in July 1961 to apply for membership of the European Communities. Officially, the application was said to be to discover the terms on which membership would actually be available. In reality, the intention was to join the community unless the terms available were so poor as to be unacceptable to a majority of the House of Commons. Macmillan had a comfortable majority, and since it was not thought that the terms would prove unacceptable, we can say here unhesitatingly that the intention was membership. After 18 months, most of them filled with detailed, wearisome negotiations, those ministers and officials on the evening of 14th of January 1963, who happened to be watching the television news bulletins, saw a brief but startling excerpt from one of General de Gaulle's monthly press conferences. They saw and heard that conventional, old-fashioned, long-nosed, rebellious character pronounce, with a lugubrious face and a Gallic shrug, that Britain might perhaps one day come around to transforming itself enough to belong to the European community without restriction and reservation, and placing it ahead of everything else. But, he added, as things stood, it is also possible that England is not yet prepared to do this. And that, indeed, appears to be the outcome of the long, long Brussels talks. The government chose to regard this statement as ambiguous. Within 3 weeks, it was clear that the general meant everything he said and was simply expressing himself courteously, or moderately so. France would negotiate no further. The other five member states of the community accepted that, and the United Kingdom did not enter the European Community for another decade on the 1st of January 1973. It is easy to see why the refusal of the community to accept British membership has now become a matter of such intense debate. Firstly, the debate has its origins in the United Kingdom's dismal economic experiences of the 1960s, the decade when it was excluded from the community. From that decade comes the argument, still loudly resonating, that the post-war history of the United Kingdom would have been entirely different had it joined the European Community in 1963 or in 1957 by becoming a signatory of the Treaty of Rome. Or, as one of the most distinguished of the school's governors, the former president of the Board of Trade, Edmund Dell, has this year argued in an excellent book, in 1952 by becoming a signatory of the Treaty of Paris. The range of arguments adduced in favor of this view, greatly simplified, could be as follows. The political definition of the United Kingdom's place in the world would have been settled, and as a consequence, the strain on the balance of payments would have been less. Exports would have flowed to the most rapidly growing markets, those of Western Europe. there would have been less expenditure on worldwide defence. Britain would still have been the favoured target of inward foreign investment, as it had been before the treaties of Rome. The Stirling area, largely contiguous with the Commonwealth and the Empire, would have dissolved much earlier, and this would have been to Stirling's benefit. Membership of the community would have been to Stirling's benefit in other ways. The rate of growth of national income would have been higher, comparable perhaps to that of France in the 1960s. The rate of growth of productivity improvement would have been higher, comparable perhaps to that of the six EEC members. Of course, present Eurosceptics believe none or very little of this. And even as I recited those arguments, I am sure many of you were formulating counter-arguments in your own mind, and doing so, in many instances, with very little difficulty. But if the economic arguments that entry into the European community at any time up to 1963 would have transformed the United Kingdom's experience in the 1960s do not carry final conviction, let me emphasize here that although the prime purpose of the 1961 application was political, it was certainly believed by ministers that entry would improve the growth rate of national income and thus make possible the expensive social programs to which they were committed. Second stimulation has, of course, been the question, should Britain leave? The terms of entry which did turn out to be on offer in 1961-63 were deeply disappointing to many ministers. They feared their rejection by the Conservative Party. There were probably then, perhaps as now, between 30 and 40 Conservative MPs who might not have gone into the division lobbies with the government. In terms of ratifying a treaty of accession, this did not matter so much. There were perhaps between 60 and 70 Labour MPs who would have supported accession and either abstained or voted with the government. But from early summer 1962, opinion polls were slipping against the government, steadily and remorselessly. Many other unfavourable things were happening. The Minister for Defence, for example, was having an affair with a woman with whom the Soviet military attaché was also having an affair. But it was thought by most analysts that the reason for the loss of popularity was the unpopularity of the emerging terms for European community membership. Only two ministers can be said to have openly opposed those terms in cabinet, neither very strongly. Lack of enthusiasm for them, however, was the predominant mood. The possibility of withdrawal from the supposedly irreversible treaties of Rome has always been discussed within government since 1962, even before the possibility of signing the treaties was vouched. My central question tonight is, why did the United Kingdom not enter the European community in 1961-63? From the answer to that question, however, many other things flow, not least answers also to the questions whether Britain could or should have entered the community earlier than 1963. It is sometimes said, and written, that the answer to my question is a simple one. Britain did not join because General de Gaulle stopped it. That, for example, is the view of Edward Heath, the minister with daily responsibility in Brussels for those long, long negotiations, and subsequently Prime Minister. It has always been Mr. Heath's view that de Gaulle spoke as he did, when he did, precisely because the negotiations were on the brink of success. De Gaulle did not want Britain in, and he had to act, taking the risk in so acting that he would lose the Franco-German alliance and the Franco-German friendship treaty, the cornerstones of his foreign policy. The chief official responsible for those talks, however, Sir Pearson Dixon, took at the time, and has maintained afterwards, a different view from the minister to whom he was immediately responsible. Dixon believed that at the time, at the time de Gaulle spoke, there were still many important outstanding issues unsettled, in spite of the length of the negotiations, and that over the last 4 months of negotiations, virtually no progress was being made towards settling them. That General de Gaulle was opposed to the British entry at the time is beyond doubt. Whether he could in fact have stopped British entry at any time before January 1963 is a serious question. The weight of the evidence that he could not have done so is very strong. Only by the 1st of July 1962 had de Gaulle emerged from the two referendums in France and Algeria which established the independence of that country. Only on the 28th of October 1962 did he win the referendum establishing the direct election of the President of the Fifth Republic. Only on the 25th of November did the general election in France give him a Gaullist majority in the National Assembly. Only in January 1963 did the Nassau agreements on Polaris missiles present him with an occasion where he might hope to rally some French and some European opinion behind the idea of Britain as a mere satellite of the United States and not a truly European country. Had the derogations, temporary and permanent, from the Treaty of Rome, which Britain requested, been less, had negotiations been completed earlier, so the official Whitehall inquest into the negotiations argued, Britain could have entered the community before de Gaulle was strong enough to say no. Or the case for refusing British entry would have been so weak that any veto by the French government would have sacrificed the construction of the common market and the common agricultural policy and perhaps other foreign policy aims too. It was not French reluctance, prevarication, and opposition to British entry which so prolonged these negotiations, prolonged them enough to give de Gaulle the opportunity he probably sought. The reasons for Britain's failure to enter the community lie not in French politics after 1958, but in Britain's own long-run history and economic development. I group these reasons here under four separate themes, but they are, as you will see, so closely intertwined that the separations are somewhat artificial. Firstly, among the reasons for the failure of Britain to gain accession must be listed the firm definition of the country's foreign commercial policy over the winter of 1951-1952. It was then that the priorities of Britain's post-war foreign commercial policy were finally determined after many false starts. The phrase used by officials among themselves to describe the primary objective of that policy from then onwards was the one world system. The phrase signified a non-discriminatory, multilateral, worldwide international trade and payments framework, something like that first described by the Bretton Woods agreements. They had been abandoned in 1947 by the United States in favor of the discriminatory European Customs and Political Union. Only through such a one-world system, officials and ministers agreed, could the United Kingdom escape the fate of becoming just one more medium-sized European country, as it has now become. The one-world system would maximize the United Kingdom's inherited advantages. The fact that it was the world's second greatest international trader, the fact that it had been the world's greatest foreign lender for a century, the fact that 40% of the settlements of world trade and lending were still made in London, the fact that most of that 40% was settled in sterling, the fact that these settlements were largely made up of the trade bills and interest payments of British Commonwealth countries, of colonies and of dependent territories scattered around the whole globe, the fact that these Commonwealth countries and dependent territories could still give the United Kingdom a much greater status than that of just another medium-sized European country. In short, the one world system built on the inheritance of the United Kingdom's extraordinary 19th century history and intended to use that strength as the foundation of a post-war international strategy for prosperity and security. The choice of the one world system had many implications, but the one that concerns us, especially on this occasion tonight, is that it was a strategy opposed to any lasting form of discriminatory economic union in Western Europe, and thus opposed to the choice of a common market, which France finally made in the treaties of Rome. The second is that it permitted the United Kingdom itself to continue as a member of the world's biggest discriminatory trade bloc, the Commonwealth, until such time as the one world system could be created. That could only be when the United States, as British officials would have said, came to its senses, since the most important step to the One World system was for the USA itself to bring down its own tariffs and other protectionist barriers. And the second most important step was for the USA to bring pressure on the EEC to merge into the One World system. The definitional moment of the One World system would be that moment when sterling was declared legally and automatically convertible into US dollars for all except residents of the UK at a single exchange rate, rather than the multiple rates which existed in the 1950s, and when other Western European currencies followed the lead of sterling immediately into the same legal convertibility. At that moment, the European Payments Union, which sheltered the spectacular growth of intra-Western European trade by providing such favorable credit terms to long-term debtors, would be broken up. Trade discrimination between Europe and North America would cease. GATT would spring to life again, and in a grand most favored nation tariff bargaining session, American tariffs would be beaten down by the huge bargaining power of reconstructed Western Europe, led by the United Kingdom. That, for British officials, was the one far-off divine event to which the whole creation moved. In that divine event, there was no room, economically or politically, for discriminatory arrangements in Western Europe. They divided the Western world and harmed, while they lasted, Britain's own economic interests. Until the creation moved in the right direction, however, as American officials and politicians accurately complained, the Commonwealth would go on happily discriminating against US exports. In British government eyes, Commonwealth trade preferences and tariff exemptions were a diminishing asset, and in the eyes of some critics, not even an asset at all, because of their effect on the geographical distribution of British trade. But the chances of beating down American tariffs and non-tariff barriers were self-evidently higher if these preferences could be thrown into the bargain. Britain had resisted, successfully, the elimination of Commonwealth preferences as the price of the post-war dollar loan, other than as a very general long-term objective. They were held in reserve after 1952 as a bargaining counter for the One World system. The crucial point here is that the decision to apply for membership of the community in 1961 did not in any way change these objectives. It signified a change in tactics, not a change in strategy. Before 1961, Britain's dealings with the communities were shaped by two policy decisions. One was that the United Kingdom could not join, because it meant discrimination against Commonwealth exports, perhaps reinforced by some unacceptable form of political federation or union. The other was that the United Kingdom could not openly oppose, because some form of political association or union in continental Western Europe was a prime objective of American security policy. Policy necessarily, therefore, concentrated on forcing adjustments of EEC commercial policy to prevent Europe being divided by the actions of the Six. Harold Macmillan merely devised new tactics. He insisted that the primary strategic objective could not be obtained while Britain was not a member state of the community. This was not without an underlying economic rationale. Macmillan seems to have subscribed to the growing belief that membership of the community followed, as he hoped, by the eventual inclusion of the community in the One World system, would stimulate a higher level of growth in the British economy. The motivation for the application, nevertheless, sprang first and foremost from the continuity of existing foreign policy. The One World system remained the policy priority, thought to be the best formula for a world order in which the United Kingdom could maximize its surviving power and influence. Drawing on its inherited worldwide strengths would guarantee that Britain would remain America's closest and most influential ally. The way to retain pride of place in Washington was to become the dominant influence inside the community, while not sacrificing any of the strength and influence which the Commonwealth relationships brought. The popular media headline used to describe the application, "Britain Chooses Europe," was, to say the least, economical with the truth, for it omitted the reasons for that choice. The decision to apply was a political decision in pursuit of a grand political strategy, to which an economic rationale was attached. It became apparent in community capitals during the negotiation that there was no real sentiment in Whitehall or Westminster in favour of the community as a counterweight to the USA. This faintly weakened the British case. What weakened it much more was the views which appeared of the relative importance of Europe and the Commonwealth. The crucial issue at stake for ministers, the one that divided them, and the one that divided the public, was whether, on entering the European community, Britain could still retain that leadership of the Commonwealth which was essential to future influence in Washington, and thus to realizing the grand strategic objective. To put it simply, that objective put Europe third. As this became apparent in the negotiations, the hopes of using the other five member states against France faded steadily. They grumbled, and even at times denounced de Gaulle after his speech. But they did so because of the fears aroused by his defence policy, not because of any strong preference for Britain's one-world system over their own common market. They had won that painfully, and throughout the negotiations, there is no moment when they wished to see it drowned in an unregulated worldwide market, even if that meant incurring the dangers and suffering the arrogance of de Gaulle's government. Secondly, this tactical shift draws our attention to other reasons for the failure of Britain's application. Could the Commonwealth relationships be retained into this one world system if Britain joined the community? Duncan Sandys, on a mission to Australia in summer 1961 to warn the Australian government what was afoot and to canvass their opinion, after 4 days of discussions, was forced to listen to Harold Holt, then Treasury Minister, subsequently Prime Minister, summing up the discussions to say that Australian ministers cannot see the outcome except in forms of a weakening of the Commonwealth. This was also the opinion of the governments of India, New Zealand, and most vehemently of Canada. John Diefenbaker's populist anti-American stance won him 2 Canadian general elections and kept him in office after a third, barely. He would have wished to pose as leader of the Commonwealth against the British application. There was no unified entity to lead, of course. However harsh the outcome for Australia's trade, it became evident that if all the preferences and tariff exceptions which protected Australian exports to Britain were to be threatened or even removed by British membership of the community, this could still be understood as a challenge in Canberra. Australia had, after all, its own manifest destiny, which linked it ultimately to the United States. The New Zealand government had nothing to gain from joining Diefenbaker in opposition. Its only possible tactic was to reiterate in Wellington that the British government would not abandon New Zealand. The Six, in fact, made a favourable statement in August 1962 that they would consider a special commercial protocol for New Zealand's exports. It was never entirely clear afterwards whether France had agreed to the wording of that statement. But in Wellington, Prime Minister Keith Holyoake used it to show New Zealand's people that Britain had not abandoned his country. We do not know whether there would in fact have been such a protocol, but for some ministers, notably the allegedly pro-European Sandys and Soames, it became by October 1962 a fundamental condition of any British treaty of accession. For 10 years after de Gaulle lowered the curtain on these ambiguities, the annual meeting of the New Zealand Society of Economists always drank its after-dinner toast to General de Gaulle. This seems to be one of the very rare recorded instances of Franco-New Zealand amity. About Canada's opposition, perhaps no more need be said than the following. Protectionism and populism there went hand in hand, and Diefenbaker's government twice turned down proposals for an Anglo-Canadian free trade area, which the British government, of course, saw as a step towards the one world system. Most officials in the Department of External Affairs were Liberal appointees and believed that ultimately Canada's destiny lay in some form of North American free trade area, as indeed did British officials. Diefenbaker communicated secretly with his own High Commissioner in London, Norman Robertson, and emptied his own waste paper basket every night, just in case officials from the Department of External Affairs were going through it to discover his secret communications. In such circumstances, his opposition became a personal crusade, used for re-election to a third term, but the story shows the decisiveness and the divisiveness of Britain's application. It had exactly the opposite effect in the long run to that which ministers sought to bring about in the Commonwealth. This was also because in the course of the negotiations, Britain did not obtain the terms it wanted for linking the Commonwealth to membership. It had hoped that as late as August 1962, it would obtain what it called comparable outlets for Commonwealth exports to Britain. Comparable, that is, in quantity, not in value, to the markets protected by tariff preferences under the 1932 Ottawa agreements. Far from obtaining these comparable outlets, by August 1962, it had discovered that there was no escape from the facts that, firstly, preferences would end on the day of the United Kingdom's accession, and secondly, there would only be a transition period of 7 years over which some outlets comparable to the markets previously offered would be provided, but diminishing annually. Commercially, at least, the gloomy predictions of Holt, Diefenbaker, and Holyoake had been fulfilled. This raised the question of what would happen to the roughly 50% of British exports which went to the Commonwealth. How far that percentage actually depended on tariff preferences offered by Commonwealth markets was a matter of much argument at the time, and that argument has not been settled. To accept the terms might mean that Commonwealth countries would bargain directly with the six by extending equivalent preferences to them. This outcome had to be accepted, of course, and the six showed no signs of demanding an end to British preferences in the Commonwealth. Like British ministers and officials, they probably thought that retaining preferences, which they then might share, would be a useful bargaining counter against the United States. It was not there that the problem lay. It lay in two other directions. One was the fear that if Britain accepted these terms as a stage in the negotiations and then did not gain accession, Commonwealth countries would offer preferences to the six in return for preferences there, even when Britain had failed to join. This was in fact exactly what Nigeria did in 1964. The other was the fear that Conservative MPs, the party and the country, would not support a settlement which sacrificed Commonwealth exports to Britain. This was the more serious because the financial regulation of the extended community, on which France unequivocally insisted, meant that the own resources of the community would come from levies on food imports. The more food, that is to say, that the United Kingdom imported from Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, the more disproportionate would its share of financing the community become. Suppose it were accepted in August 1962 that the trick could not finally be turned, that there would be only 7 more years in which room could be made for Commonwealth food exports to Britain. Was that long enough to preserve preferences until the one world system had been built? And in that period and afterwards, could Britain still retain enough importance in the Commonwealth to use those Commonwealth relationships in Washington? Ministers decided that the answer to the first question was yes. The reason was the announcement of the Trade Expansion Bill by President Kennedy. Ministers took that as the start of the one world system for which they had long hoped. American anxieties over low growth rates and low rates of export growth compared to those of Western Europe had at last, they believed, led to the end of American protectionism. An expanded European community, including the United Kingdom, would have formidable trade bargaining power against the USA, the one world system would be born, and the disruption to Commonwealth exports would be brief. The Commonwealth had in fact not prospered from the post-war world of preferences, Australia and New Zealand had low rates of growth of real personal incomes, stagnant indeed, between the end of the great wool boom in 1951 and Britain's application. With America and its new administration facing at last the reality of the need for a one world system, Commonwealth countries would grow more rapidly in a felicitous symbiosis with the expanded community and with the USA and with Britain together. It has been argued in print by Kaiser that the decision to pursue the negotiations after August 1962, once the bad terms had been discovered, was a turning point in British history. That was the date when the Commonwealth was finally sacrificed to Europe, vainly, as it turned out. This seems an absolute misunderstanding. It was the United States Trade Expansion Act which offered the prospect of ending discrimination, both by the EEC and by the Commonwealth at the same time. It was the light at the end of the tunnel, which ministers hoped meant, in the end of the European community as a genuinely separate political organization with its own law and its own governance. The answer to the second question, would Britain still be able to bring Commonwealth influence to bear in Washington, was, accordingly, also yes. You may detect in this reasoning a remarkable pervasiveness of wishful thought. The European community had no intention of opening its agricultural markets in the so-called Kennedy Round in Ghat, which followed the Trade Expansion Act. Indeed, it was not even ready to do so in the Uruguay Round 30 years later. The United Kingdom was seen as a major market for French and Dutch food surpluses, most of them directly competitive with Commonwealth food exports. There were severe political limitations on the degree to which American tariffs on manufactures would be reduced, and non-tariff barriers were not a matter for GATT bargaining. Most wishful of all, it turned out to be the six, not a 7, 8, 9, or 10 led by Britain, which bargained down American tariffs in the Kennedy Round, leaving Britain to fight its own corner, and leaving Commonwealth countries to use their own preferences for their own bargains. Acceptance of the terms of entry, insofar as they related to Commonwealth trade with Britain, was in pursuit of a 19th century fantasy. World markets for manufacturers regulated only by tariffs. There was no reason why, say, Australia, 80% of whose exports in the 1950s were agricultural, should accept such a fantasy as reassuring. The community pursued its own 20th century policy of market regulation and trade expansion combined. The Commonwealth drew its own conclusions, and its weight in British influence at Washington diminished steadily from summer 1962 onwards. Ministers became increasingly divided and uncertain. The negotiations slowed down. Britain did not get in. This brings us to the third reason why the British application failed. It is the impact of the empire question on British party politics. It may seem very odd to followers of the great debate over Britain and the European community now that the issue which occupied most of the time and energy of politicians, officials, and the media in 1961-63 was not the one which now seems central to that debate. It was not the issue of parliamentary and national sovereignty, not the question of whether the United Kingdom would still be able to pursue its own macroeconomic policies, not the question of whether Britain would survive as an independent nation. It was the future of the British Commonwealth and the British Empire. This was the issue on which the Eurosceptics fought their battle in 1961-63 against the decision to join the community. The issue of sovereignty was summarily dealt with. The supremacy of European community law was perfectly acceptable, because in most common policy areas, where it was considered Britain had changes to make, those changes were few and acceptable. The ever closer union was not taken seriously because of de Gaulle. It had been substituted by de Gaulle's own vision of political union, the Europe of the nations. It was even thought that because of that vision, he might actually be favourable to British membership. For opponents of accession, therefore, empire was the alternative. This was not because America had never shown any serious interest in an Atlantic free trade area or a customs union. much less, of course, at any form of close political association with the United Kingdom. Indeed, it was a noticeable characteristic of those who advocated empire as the alternative to Europe that they did so to preserve Britain from American dominance. Empire was the alternative because of the way it had been used in the 19th century, especially after 1890, to reshape the national myth of a United Kingdom. Because of this reshaping of the national myth, neither party achieved a coherent concept after 1945 of the possible scope of genuine independence of action, either from America or from the European community. When, firstly, the terms of the dollar loan and, later, the application to join the community required such a concept, the party political system was too fractured to provide it. And the cause of that fracture was the inherited debate over empire and the way that the national myth had been influenced by that debate. What the United Kingdom was actually negotiating was the future of what ecological historians have now come to call Neo-Europe. The outstanding characteristic of 19th century imperialism was that Europeans exported themselves, their crops, their domestic animals, their wild fauna, and their pathogens to ecological zones where they could reproduce the patterns of agricultural production of temperate Europe. The USA, Canada, Argentina, Uruguay, Australia, New Zealand, the list is not complete. In this process, Britain had been by far the dominant power. The Brussels negotiations were negotiations in which Britain was brought finally to attempt to close this episode. Should it continue to attempt to organize the world economy, to take responsibility for Neo-Europe, even at the expense of the European leg of its own grand strategy for its own national future? The Treaty of Rome did, of course, make provision for empire. It made provision for France's 19th century empire, which, except for part of Algeria, was not Neo-Europe. Europe did not have a pineapple crop, a tea crop, a coffee crop, a cocoa crop. The Treaty of Rome's arrangements for African countries were for poor and small tropical exporters. They were acceptable after many complaints to the community because the exports of those countries did not compete with European exports. Because exporters from other European countries had some feeble expectations of African markets, and because looking after Africa gave the community some kind of foreign policy and thus some kind of political personality. But the arrangements for association under the treaty proved in the negotiations to be no way out for the British Empire. Arrangements made for France's empire proved quantitatively and qualitatively useless as a model for the British Empire. Quantitatively, the difference in trade values is striking. Commonwealth exports to the United Kingdom in 1960 were more than three times the value of exports to metropolitan France from the franc zone. Commonwealth exports, excluding British exports, to the community were more than five times greater than franc zone exports, excluding French exports, to the other five member states. As far as values are concerned, therefore, the only way the expanded community could provide comparable outlets for the British Commonwealth and Empire exports was by confining most of them to Britain. To do that broke the ground rules of the Treaty of Rome. It infringed the decisions on market regulation so painstakingly made in the treaty. It was not communautaire. It could not be fitted into that vision of its national future on which France had managed, with such severe internal difficulty, to agree in 1956. Nor could it be fitted to similar versions in the other member states. Qualitatively, the fact that the British Commonwealth and Empire was exceeded only by the United States as the triumph of Neo-Europe made this problem even more insolvable. 3 million tons of Canadian wheat a year, plus the large quantities which Germany still hoped to import, 750,000 tons of Australian wheat, 290,000 tons of dead sheep from New Zealand, plus dead sheep from Australia. The continent didn't eat much of that, but it threatened their beef and veal prices. 170,000 tons of New Zealand butter. Where was the future room for French wheat and butter surpluses, or for Dutch butter and veal exports? Where was the room for maintaining and improving agricultural incomes on the continent? Qualitatively, if looking after black Africa was in the end an acceptable small financial charge on Bonn, on Rome, and on The Hague, with some political returns, why should German, Italian, and Dutch farmers have to make a market for rich, white Australian and New Zealanders? The per capita income of New Zealand in the early 1950s was recorded, falsely, I think, as being as high as that of the United States and Switzerland. And, from an African point of view, qualitatively, another issue arose. In Accra, Lagos, and similar areas with a long history of widespread international trade, with a larger, a more complex, and a more cosmopolitan political elite, France's arrangements, embodied in the Treaty of Rome, was simply a form of neo-colonialist imperialism. A phrase used by Kwame Nkrumah. Almost the only relief that British negotiators had in the negotiations was to find that no French negotiator could think of a reasonable argument to place on the table to deny to British African colonies in Africa, or even emergent dominions, the associated overseas territory status accorded by the Treaty of Rome to French African territories. The relief was short-lived. West Africa did not want it. It was too politically suspect. It is probably not remembered by anyone now that one British African territory, the Central African Federation, applied for association with the European Economic Community before Britain applied for membership. The purpose was all too clear. It was to keep in power the white settler government in Salisbury at the expense of the breakaway movements in Zimbabwe and Malawi, and Malawi. Then, of course, in northern Rhodesia and in Nyasaland, now, of course, Zimbabwe and Malawi. The purpose, of course, was largely ignored by British negotiators. It was something better not to think about. British files on that application of the Central African Federation actually get into their fifth thick volume before they mention those two critical words, black and white. It is usually said that the resolution of France's imperial past, earlier and more successfully than Britain's, was due to the shift in public opinion brought about by the terrible wars in Vietnam and in Algeria. They were indeed terrible, and Britain had no such experience. They did indeed have a powerful impact on political opinion, including that of de Gaulle himself. But I hope I have said enough here to show that the problems of Britain's imperial past could not be resolved through the same mechanism. France was able to incorporate the economic welfare of its empire into the community structure because it was far less economically disturbing to that structure, and because in the negotiations for the Treaty of Rome, it was obvious to all other five member states that France's foreign policy and defense concerns had to be primarily in Western Europe. For Paris, Europe had to come first. As I said, for London, it still came third. As the question of empire became more insistent, the party system fragmented, and ministers became ever more fearful of putting the issue to the people. They had never undertaken any campaign of persuasion, as they did in 1972. Far from it. Because it was only tactics, they did the opposite. Polls tell us that ignorance about the European community in Britain was massive. Ministers rather hoped that it would remain so. Europe had more extensively and ambitiously propagated empire as a national myth than the United Kingdom. But objections to empire in the United Kingdom had never entirely overcome the imperial yearnings of the late 19th century. Of those objections, the strongest always seems to have been that political rather than commercial empire was not actually worth the money invested in it. That objection was submerged after 1890 by the dynastic and imperialist rhetoric and imagery consciously deployed as part of British nation-building ceremonial, much of it military. The parsimony with which colonies were treated in the interwar period showed this to be only a submersion, not a change of heart, but in educational institutions, the importance of empire and an acknowledgement that it was a crucially distinguishing feature of British history was a prominent part of the teaching. At the popular sentimental level, as all the polls show us, Commonwealth and Empire were not foreign. Western Europe was. And this long inculcated assumption was to be increasingly important over the years 1961 to 1963. Against an empire founded on ideals of fairness, justice, and public service, Eurosceptics opposed a bleak moral picture of Western European democracies, for the most part, in their eyes, ill-founded, corrupt, and thoroughly unreliable. This, of course, was not a debate about Europe. It was a debate about British domestic society and political life and the changes taking place within it. If the Eurosceptics of the day were using the empire as a metaphor for their own vision of the United Kingdom, exactly the same can be said about many of the Europhiles, especially those within the Labour Party. The 19th century division over the merits of empire re-emerged strongly in the 1960s, disguised as rhetoric over the alternative and higher merits of, in quotes, choosing Europe. Membership of the community, the acceptance of its alleged norms, became in the 1960s the revived programme of the 19th century liberal critics of imperial, political, and economic overextension. What was to become the dissident Europhile wing of the Labour Party, and later most of the Social Democratic Party, saw the choice of Europe as the route to that secure middle-class prosperity to which the majority of Labour Party voters believed to aspire. It is in no way surprising that the most prominent 20th century inheritor of the Gladstonian critique of empire, Roy Jenkins, now Lord Jenkins of Hillhead, should have become a European commissioner after splitting the Labour Party. It is in no way surprising that the fragmentation of the party political system should have become so prominent at the time and remained so prominent since. Those were the years in which, to British visitors, as many now recall, the French suddenly seemed to have stopped living in dark, insanitary houses and not having telephones. Taken out of hiding, what were alleged to be their secret hoards of money from the war, and suddenly suspected of having more cars and refrigerators per head than the British. Our defending Australia was thought by Europhiles to be one cause of this. The application and its success were not to be put to referendum. They were to be put to a general election as the coup which would guarantee Macmillan's re-election. Passing a treaty of accession in the Commons with Labour support and Labour abstention against 30 to 40 hostile members of one's own party, when opinion polls suggested that outside the House of Commons the cause was decidedly more unpopular still on the terms which had been obtained, none of this looked like the way to win a general election. That is another reason why the negotiations slowed down. Fourthly, I have left the European Free Trade Association out of this, but that too is another reason why Britain did not gain accession. EFTA had failed entirely as a way of forcing adjustments in the community's commercial policies. Within a year of joining it, Britain had applied to join the community. Mr. Heath gave a strong pledge in Parliament that the United Kingdom would not enter the community unless satisfactory arrangements had been made for all other EFTA members before British entry. We do not know how far this pledge would have been honoured. No steps were taken to break it, but it is hard to believe that it would have been honoured. Its vainglory was soon evident. Applying for community membership proved more of a barrier to bringing the seven EFTA countries into the one world system than a step towards that goal. Denmark applied for membership conditional on British entry. Norway did so rather later. Opinion polls in Norway ominously gave the same reading as they did in the last two lost referendums there. Salazar contemplated membership for Portugal only after the completion of a customs union between Portugal and its own empire. Sweden, Switzerland, and Austria were neutral countries, and the Soviet Union made all too clear its view that an Austrian application for membership would be a step towards a second Anschluss, and thus a fundamental breach of the 1955 Strait Treaty. Most of this was foreseeable, although some of it was not foreseen in Whitehall. Above all, however, what was not foreseen was America's attitude. The United States ministers were informed by Assistant Secretary of State George Ball that support for EFTA's relations with the European Economic Community was not conducive to America's national interest. Support might be given, he told the British government, if the question were restricted to the United Kingdom joining the six, perhaps with Denmark and Norway. That, perhaps, was diplomatic finesse. It was with deep reluctance that America later, finally and grudgingly accepted that Danish membership must come if Britain joined. It offered no support to Norway and came to the conclusion, probably justified by later history, that a Norwegian application was more trouble to the United States than it was worth. As for the rest of them, they were seen, except for Portugal, as a bunch of free riders. They should be left to look after themselves, in Gat. That would teach them to stop being neutral and dividing the free world. What the USA wanted was the United Kingdom, preferably alone, to enter the community as a counterweight to General de Gaulle, and thus as a contribution to America's own security. The official US policy position, not fully revealed in London, was that the association of neutrals would detract from the political character of the European community and emphasize its purely commercial aspects. If the neutrals came in as associates, it would be difficult not to go further. The addition of a number of fringe nations could only cause distractions and damage the climate of intimacy and concentration on common problems. It would be the beginning of a road of which the end was not clear. If there are any citizens of the Irish Republic listening to me, I should add that that country, not a member of EFTA, but neutral, and almost entirely dependent on British markets, was every bit regarded in Washington as much as a nuisance, a free rider, and a fringe nation. Where then was the one world system and the unity of the Western world which Britain hoped to bring about? I hope in answering my central question that I have said enough to come to some conclusions about the United Kingdom's first attempt to enter the European community. In spite of the public professions to the contrary, the United Kingdom did not accept the spirit of the Treaty of Rome, and it hoped, eventually, to alter the letter. By the spirit of the treaty, I do not mean those aspirations to an ever closer union. With de Gaulle in power, that held no fears and little meaning. The spirit of the treaty was something more immediate, an attempt to create, among a group of rich, contiguous countries, a system of careful market regulation and supervision which encouraged trade expansion while protecting the personal security, income, and welfare gains on which post-war electorates in those countries had all insisted. It was not that the social welfare provisions of the treaty posed any serious difficulties to Macmillan's government, or in any way were rejected there. It was rather that a way had to be found to preserve what the United Kingdom had itself achieved in that direction, but in the context of a worldwide economic system, which it was thought was necessary to preserve those social advances. The reason it was necessary could be simplified, without too much distortion, into one short phrase: Britain's 19th century history. I hope I have shown, too, that this was no romantic fantasy of past glories which should have been shed. Every issue I have discussed here was a modern, real, economic or political issue bearing immediately on the incomes, welfare and political future of other societies, as well as the United Kingdom. The Treaty of Rome was, simply, not a framework within which such issues could be regulated. De Gaulle, no friend of that treaty, saw that clearly. Could the United Kingdom really enter that European framework with, as he put it, ce grand convoi? The answer was no, even if it took him to say so to the world. The task set by ministers to officials in 1961-63 was hopeless, therefore. From this, the conclusion must follow that Britain could not have signed the treaties of Rome either. It could not have joined the European Economic Community at the outset in 1956-1957, any more than in 1961-1963, without ultimately destroying the purpose of the treaty. It is true that the Treaties of Rome mark the failure of the course of British commercial policy set in 1952. Most of Whitehall and Westminster, however, preferred to believe, until November 1956, that the French could not possibly sign the Treaties of Rome. Afterwards, it preferred to believe that the common market and its common policies would collapse from the inside, and that they were thus a temporary phenomenon. The spirit of the treaties, the mutual commitment to the income and welfare gains, the political compromises, and the deeper, more popular nature of post-war democracies were entirely disregarded in London. It was only their commercial and foreign policy aspects with which the higher levels of British government were concerned. And those aspects were unacceptable. Accordingly, the arrangements must be undone, if gradually. After Macmillan fell from power, those same long-run divisions in the Labour Party that I have tried here to explain prevented any effective reorientation of policy. What made membership possible in 1972 was not a resolution of these dilemmas that I have described. The party system remained, and still remains, just as fractured on this issue as in 1963. What made membership possible was that Le Grand Convoi broke up and sailed away in different directions. Britain did not desert the Commonwealth commercially. The Commonwealth, taking its cue, of course, from 1961-63, deserted Britain. The Treaty of Rome, substantially unaltered, except for the vague promise of a common currency, then became an appropriate framework for resolving what was left, not much of Britain's 19th century impact on the world. If Britain could not have entered the community in 1956-57 or 1961-63, could it have done so by entering that far more limited organisation, the European Coal, Iron and Steel Community, in 1952? Had it entered through that first door, would it then have passed through the others? Edmund Dell is surely right in denouncing as irrelevant the domestic obstacles to participating in the Schuman Plan talks, or to signing the Treaty of Paris. The objections of the National Coal Board were shown later to be irrelevant when France's nationalised coal industry maintained its cartelised domestic price zoning as well as its import and distribution cartel. The objections of the National Union of Mine Workers were shown to be irrelevant when the high authority of the coal and steel community supported and subsidised employment in the much less competitive Belgian coal industry until 1958. The divisions of opinion within the British steel industry were no greater, perhaps less, than those in Belgium, France, Italy, and Germany, and the manufacturers could have been faced down by any reasonably resolute government. The allegedly weak French governments did exactly that. So did the supposedly weak Belgian government in the face of a xenophobic campaign against the Treaty of Paris, jointly financed by Belgian coal and steel. Trade unions in the steel industry in Britain were more in favour of entry than against. No firm line had yet been determined for Britain's post-war commercial policy, and, in any case, it was not clear that entry into the coal and steel community would have any further bearing on markets other than those for coal, iron and steel. Some objections raised were that close involvement or cooperation with France's domestic reconstruction plans was not advantageous, that French diplomacy had taken too high-handed a line in engineering a rapprochement with Germany without long consultations with Britain, that no commitment to Europe could extend to defence because that was too dangerous, chaining yourself to a corpse, as Bevin elegantly put it, that there must be a prior commitment given by participants in those talks to reach agreement on a supranational governance of the sectors in question, and that this was unacceptable as a negotiating method and as a principle of governance, that it was unacceptable because in the long run it had implications for political union, perhaps federation in Europe, but none of these were the real objection. Why were British governments so concerned about these last implications, a possible political union in 1950, and so cavalier about them in 1961-63? It took 2 days to settle the questions of national sovereignty in 1961-63. The answer is the determination from the start of the Marshall Plan to oppose and thwart all American plans for a United States of Europe. The germ of the one world policy was already there. One can see it in that old imperialist Hugh Gaitskell's juggling when Treasury Minister with the usefulness or otherwise of the European Payments Union. It was not Stafford Cripps's objections that planning must be national and planning was essential that blocked Britain's entry into the coal and steel community. It was the Labour Party's concern to maximise the value of Britain's past, together with its general ignorance and even dislike of a group of countries with which, for extremely good reasons, it had had no elective affinities since 1940. The anecdote springs to mind of Herbert Morrison receiving a visit from Guy Mollet, the French Prime Minister who later signed the Treaty of Rome, in Mollet's capacity as French representative to the Socialist International. Mollet had said he would like to discuss cooperation between British and French planning. Morrison had drafted a two-line letter saying, "This is a subject of no interest to the United Kingdom, and I feel we hardly need talk about it." And it was suggested to him by his parliamentary secretary that this was a quite unnecessarily brusque reply to a man who was coming in no official government capacity, but merely as a delegate of the Socialist International, and that it might be desirable for diplomatic reasons for Morrison to amend his letter to a more courteous form. And he pondered his letter and struck out the words, "Dear Monsieur Mollet," and substituted, "Dear Comrade." That, I'm afraid, was the extent of the Labour Party's knowledge of these questions. America's plans for a security network in Western Europe based on some political union or association were thought of, as Ernest Bevin said when brought the news of the Marshall Plan, to turn Britain into just another European country. The one world system was devised eventually to support the reality that it was not just another European country yet, and the Labour Party was groping its way towards that one world system already in 1950. Those gropings were interrupted by the 1951 balance of payments crisis, but after that, and after the Conservative victory, the new government only took up more boldly a policy which Gaitskell and Wilson had begun to invent. There being, therefore, powerful emotive reasons why Britain did not enter in 1952, we must, I believe, conclude two further things. One is that Britain could and should have joined the European coal and steel community. The second is that it does not at all follow that had it done so, it would have then become a member of the European Economic Community. It is rather more probable that the European Economic Community would not have taken the form that it did, a common market. And had it not taken that form, it probably would not have sufficed to provide that combination of personal welfare and security in common that held Germany in that Western European framework and held the six together. In the end, in not joining the coal and steel community, the United Kingdom stands condemned for underestimating the importance of the irreversible binding of democratic Germany to Western Europe. And that, of course, was more important to the future of British citizens than mousetrap cheese from New Zealand, dead mutton from Australia, and hard winter wheat from Canada. It should have been a much weightier consideration in 1950. After that, it was too late. But did it matter economically? Growth would probably have been no different. Exports have been no more competitive. The balance of payments have been no better. That being said, the one world system was political and economic irrealism. It harboured dangerous illusions about the United States, whence the endless lucubrations over 20 years by British civil servants who thought the United States should pursue British national interests rather than its own. It rested too on an outmoded version of trade theory. It was far too generalized and abstract a statement of policy. An instance would be the resolution of the problem of manufactured exports from Hong Kong, India, and Pakistan in the Brussels negotiations. They were regulated by import quotas, of course. not by the multilateral worldwide free trade system that Britain was hoping to produce. The One World system was not founded on the way the British economy was managed nationally, for good or bad. Unlike the European Community, which was a close international representation of national economic management systems. I could go on. The alternative of the Eurosceptics until the mid-1970s, empire and the Commonwealth, was, of course, even more irreal. Britain was merely being asked to make a market for foodstuff exports for countries whose industrialization was pursued through import substitution policies almost entirely at the expense of British exports, and they had little else in common. The only alternative scenario which seems to me to have been politically possible was that entry into the coal and steel community would have taken place and might have been followed by further British initiatives in sectoral European management. But here, perhaps, probably, I become also irreal and ahistorical. I should stop. However, one final remark. This analysis has some pointers for what is going on now. Britain entered the European community precisely at the moment when the real strength of the community's raison d'etre was ebbing away. The end of the great boom in 1972-74 called into question, increasingly, all its policies. Technology initiatives, the Single European Act, did not restore the chances of sustaining those policies. Yet with the collapse of the wall, the primal cause of the European community had to be restated. European Monetary Union and the European Union are Germany's price to France and to the original six for unification. It seems to me to be written in my story that the United Kingdom would not see the way forward after German unification as a further desperate and dangerous effort at integration, but would, rather, celebrate the fall of the wall as opening the way once more to another version of the One World system, this time, of course, embracing Eastern Europe. France, on the other hand, must surely attempt that desperate and dangerous step. Thank you.
Thank you for that masterpiece of lucid analysis, geographically and conceptually wide-ranging. At a time when Britain now is perhaps not even just another European country, I suspect that there'll be people here who would like to continue to debate this issue for some time. Professor Millward has kindly agreed to answer questions, so we have a short time. Please identify yourself on asking your question. Or indeed impress me with just such amazing self-restraint that we don't have any questions.
Not necessarily a right assessment. I have difficulty in making my mind up whether a sufficient number of British manufacturing sectors could have actually competed inside the common market by 1963, or by the 1st of January 1964 or 1965, which might have been the entry dates. Increasingly, I think that the poor manufacturing performance in the 1960s is traced back into the 1950s.
Was it clear that the French were capable of competing? Was it clear in the mid-50s that the French were much more capable of competing than we were?
If one believes that investment does produce growth, and most economists no longer seem to believe that,
at those high investment rates in the 1950s, after de Gaulle's devaluation, perhaps did bear fruit. Yes, sorry, I thought you could hear them. No, the question I was asked was whether had Britain actually entered in 1963, this would in fact have been a stimulus to British manufacturing industry. And I'm uncertain of the answer, but I'm increasingly leaning towards the opinion that Britain might not have successfully competed, and thus growth rates might not have been higher. And the supplementary question was in fact along the lines of why, in that case, does France have a higher growth rate than any other Western European country after entry into the European community? And the only helpful suggestion I have, short of good analytical studies of French manufacturing industry in the 1960s, is that the very high investment rates of the 1950s paid off for France in the 1960s once the currency had actually been devalued in 1958. That would be my suggestion. I do have the feeling that by the late 1950s, French industry was actually in many sectors much more competitive than British manufacturing, but that this was obscured by the artificial values of the franc. Absolutely not federalist. I think this is a great myth. I see Macmillan as in common with many other British members of the European movement, as a hopelessly muddled but faintly kindly character. Someone who believed that on the whole, Western Europe was much more important to British defence and to the British future than most of the general run of British politicians. That he had, as it were, learnt that lesson from the jobs he'd had to do during the war. But the European movement, therefore, mistakenly, I'm sure, provided some vehicle for a rapprochement between Britain and Europe. The difference between espousing the cause of the European movement or of Europe generally and European integration, as eventually produced by the Treaty of Rome or the coal and steel community, seems to me a profound one. The difference does lie in the act of surrender of national sovereignty. And there is absolutely no evidence that Macmillan believed that any sovereignty ought or should be surrendered. Once de Gaulle was in power, Britain thought that problem had gone away. In that sense, to go back to your first phrase, it's not unfair, it's a little exaggerated, but it's not unfair to call Macmillan a British Gaullist. There is an element of that in Macmillan. But as a man who understood the actual process of European integration, as we've come to write its history and understand it, that process which has formed the European community, Macmillan was perfectly ignorant of the whole process and would have been deeply opposed to it had he understood it. Were the British trying to get the best of both worlds by telling the Commonwealth that they couldn't do without Europe and telling Europe that they couldn't do without the Commonwealth? Yes, they were. It's wishful thinking. One can describe it in no other way.
Since the views of the major Commonwealth countries about European integration as an idea are extremely divergent, Nehru, who was bitterly regretful of Britain's application to join, nonetheless was a supporter of European integration, since he believed it did strengthen the Western world. He thought it brought stability to the world. Although British membership would bring much trouble to India. Canada, Australia both thought that all that was really happening was that America had failed to get rid of Commonwealth preferences for British exports at the time of the dollar loan and was now sticking Britain in the European community so that it could get rid of Commonwealth preferences and export to Australia and Canada. So they had a much less lofty view of the whole business than Pandit Nehru. The only large Commonwealth country that was unequivocally in favour of British membership was Malaysia, or Malaya, the Malayan Federation. But that, of course, was because of the direction of Malaya's exports. It had, of course, substantial high-value exports, not to Britain, but to Western Europe and to the United States. So that on the whole, I think, what Britain was saying to the Commonwealth about its need for Europe was certainly true, but had no resonance in the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth answer was, well, so what? And what Britain was saying to Europe about its need for the Commonwealth was wasted breath and a wasted effort at explanation, since as far as the community was concerned, the Commonwealth was simply a set of, to use their technical language, third countries. There was no conceptual difference in the community between Australia, say, and Ethiopia, or Uruguay. And it maintained that position firmly throughout the negotiations. So in the end, one has to say that this was so much wishful thinking by British governments.
Dr. Devin?
Given your rejection of any suggestion that the Macmillan government was in any way committed to the spirit of the Treaty of Rome, how can you account for the strong support given both by the United States government and by the vast majority of UK Federalists?
Well, the vast majority of European Federalists in Britain amounts to about 30 people, doesn't it?
On the continent.
Well, of course, the Federalist dream was not the same as that of the European community. I mean, most European Federalists wanted something much bigger, much larger, and perhaps, in a sense, as they would have said, more humane, and certainly more democratic, I think, than the institutions of the European community. So that many European Federalists supported British entry as a way of changing the European community. At that moment, there is some affinity, of course, between British objectives and Federalist objectives. American support for Britain and the European community is based entirely on security considerations. Once de Gaulle had come to power, it became a sine qua non of American policy to get Britain in the European community as a counterweight to de Gaulle. I think all the changes that every other possible effort to pursuing it had failed. The creation of the free trade area had been rejected. The creation of the European Free Trade Association had got Britain nowhere. Plans for harmonizing the commercial policies of the Free Trade Association and the European community, that had got nowhere. Dreams of a North Atlantic free trade area, those had got nowhere. No other avenue was left. And then, to add to that, of course, Kennedy comes in. And whereas Eisenhower tolerated in every way, as the previous administration had done, Britain's abstention from the European community, Kennedy makes it quite clear that his objective is Britain in the community. Kennedy's problem, of course, was more de Gaulle, I think, than Britain. So the combination of having tried every other avenue and failed, and the fear that if Britain did not join the community, it would lose its place at Washington because of Kennedy's wishes and ambitions, that's what changes. So that the incoming of the Kennedy administration is crucial in this decision, I'm sure.
Dr. Scott?
Again, there seems to be some confusion between the European movement and European federalism. These are not to be conflated. Does the existence of federalist movements in European countries have any great importance on the formation of the European community? Well, what I've written is what I would still say here, that at vital moments when their support is needed, then of course it does have an influence. I mean, they're there. And they can be used, but they are used by nation states for their own specific nation state building purposes. That seems to me to have still been the case in 1961, 1963. The European movement, as opposed to European federalism, that seems to me to harbour a very disparate group of people who do have some faint Gorbachevian dream of Europe as a common home, or Europe as a common house. And because that is far from being ignoble, and certainly has large elements of truth in it, it's politically mobilizable at vital moments. But the mobilizing, of course, is done by nation states pursuing national interests. Poor Macmillan in 1961-63 seems to me to have had very little of either group to mobilize. European Federalists in Britain were about as prominent as the Flat Earth movement. Supporters of the European movement in the United Kingdom, well, he stuffed two of them in his cabinet, Sands and Soames, and interestingly enough, as a footnote to what I've been saying tonight, they were the two ministers who were most sceptical by autumn 1962 about whether Britain should accept those terms and actually join the European community, and yet they were the two who had been brought in to try to push membership through. So mobilizable is in inverted commas. I'm even sceptical about whether British policy could in fact extend the European Union and the European community eastwards into Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and so on. From everything we read, this will happen. But then from everything we read, European Monetary Union will happen before that. And about that, I'm even more sceptical. I find it hard to believe that German taxpayers would actually pay for the common agricultural policy in Poland, or in Slovakia, or in the Czech Republic, or in Hungary. In that sense, I think present British policy is just as irreal as the one I'm describing. But since the one I'm describing had obviously sound foundations and good historical causes, whereas the present one seems to me to have neither, it's not only as irreal, but has even less chance of success, or even, I think, of acceptance now by the British population. There is no way out that doesn't require prior change in France. That always seems to me to be the difficulty. I cannot think that after so long a commitment, France could give up 40 years of foreign policy in Western Europe of remarkable consistency without some kind of cataclysm, and if that cataclysm occurs, then British foreign policy has obviously failed anyway. I mean, the security and of life and limb and welfare of British citizens seems to me to be governed by exactly the same things as the security, life and limb of French and German citizens. That doesn't mean that I'm in favour of European Monetary Union. As I said, I think it's a desperate and dangerous step that France has to take. I'm sceptical that it will be taken. That if it is taken, I think it will quite probably destroy the European community as I've been describing it here. Whether out of that destruction comes some real chance for Britain to pursue a real foreign policy in Western Europe, or whether out of that destruction comes the end of the longest peace in Europe, I'm not sure. It's a fearful moment, I think.
I think on that jolly note, it's time to tell you all that we can offer you a drink, because after that cataclysmic thought, I know there are still questions in the body of the House, but there aren't many of us, so if I invite you all now on behalf of the European Institute to come up to the Senior Common Room for a drink, you will have an opportunity to ask Professor Millward whatever questions still remain in your minds, but I hope before you do that you'll join me now in thanking him for a really splendid lecture. Thank you.